among the three of us, who does the most sci-fi like research?
Cool. So we're selling ourselves here.
Yeah, exactly.
Hi, I'm Chris. I've introduced myself before, but I design nanometer-sized tiny robots to hunt down and fight cancer cells within your body.
Okay, maybe we should have not started with that because that's crazy sci-fi. Hey, I'm Hannes. I'm the host of this podcast, and I visualize how molecules move at an atomic resolution. Molecules that are way too small to ever be seen by any kind of microscopy, almost, can be seen moving in living cells in almost real time. That's what I've got to offer.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Jan Philipp. Second time on the podcast, very excited. And what I spent this whole week doing was making a brain so transparent that I can see every neuron in the whole chunk of brain that I have.
Nice.
To relate to transparent what we talked about in the last podcast, in mice, right?
In mice, correct.
In mice.
No humans, okay. No humans were harmed in the making of this research.
Great.
I think transparent brains win.
Really? No, I'm absolutely off your nanobodies, which are just vesicles, right?
They're nanoparticles, yeah.
Nanoparticles,
They're not clever. Yet.
Yeah. Yet. Let's open the beers and then we see what we actually wanted to talk about, which was a bit of a different topic. We did want to talk about sci-fi today. And my initial question would have been if any one of you is annoyed by sci-fi, or at least by the inaccuracy of the science depicted in sci-fi stories, but I'm pretty sure both of you love sci-fi.
I love sci-fi, but I can get very angry about the science that is depicted in sci-fi.
Great.
Yeah, like bad sci-fi is very, very bad. Like, I cannot sit still.
Story-wise, bad.
No, sorry, not story. Like, just gross misrepresentation how anything works. Like, stuff that should be common knowledge. Like, I don't know if anybody has seen Life.
Yeah.
It's like this movie of they find a cell on Mars or something, and then it mutates within hours and becomes this thing that moves around and it's like a neuron and a muscle cell at the same time, and none of it makes any sense.
From what perspective? If we just dive into the first thing we ate early.
From a cell biology standpoint, from like how evolution works, or
can you not imagine a cell which is just much more potent in any way than our cells?
Choose one. Like, you can have it's a neuron and a muscle cell, or you can have it can grow very quickly, or you can have it can completely ignore how energy and consumption works. Like, choose any of these, but you can't have all of them.
But that's where the fiction comes in, right?
Yeah. Like, good sci-fi has like one, like, it has like a premise, it gives you like an introduction, this is the like magic that we're going to use, and then it sticks with it. Off the rails.
I didn't like Life too much either, but if I can just be the devil's avocado here, in Life, the premise is that this cell is just so much superior to our cells in how it develops and what it can do. Like, it can be a muscle cell and a neuron. I don't know why it would have to be.
Do you think the writers just read about stem cells, got the wrong end of the stick, and went, right, let's go for it?
Probably. I mean, I don't know. I think they had no background in science.
Well, cheers in any way before you drink, Chris.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Cheers. No, I agree with you.
I do think this part is an all right premise, to have some kind of superior cell which just outranks our cells in basically everything. That's why apparently it destroys everyone, the ISS, kills everyone. What I didn't like about it, I think it did not actually need mass to grow. And that's what I find the most annoying, that things keep growing in sci-fi movies without any source of mass.
Yeah. It's funny, like, where we each of us draw the line. Like, so Hannes is going for, like, conservation of energy and mass and these sorts of things. You're worried about the cell biology, about, like, which bit is going where. I get my own, like, at some point chemically, right, they need. Yeah, I mean, I suppose the conservation of mass is a fundamental one. But I suppose it depends where they base their sci-fi in. So if they're saying, like, it's this universe, but in the future, the fundamental laws still have to apply, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, to some degree, for example, if you look at Star Trek or something, like, the premise is, oh, we have some kind of ship engine and we can be faster than light, mm-hmm. which conflicts with what, like, the physics we know about the universe right now. But it's fine as long as you don't, like, change the premise like every other episode. Like, mm-hmm. right now it takes whatever, 50 minutes to get to Mars, and next episode it takes a minute, and then afterwards, yeah. we're like, the next star, it's also 15 minutes. Like, yeah. you can break the laws of physics, I think, but it has to be, like, within the framework of that you're setting up, it has to be the same.
I wonder if this is because we're scientists, and we accept that the world has universal laws and we that are consistent throughout the universe, whereas if someone who reads science fiction for the fun of science fiction, but then maybe not necessarily a scientist, wonder if it bugs them or not, because they don't, their whole job, their whole potential identity, work identity definitely, isn't based on trying to find these rules in the world.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid point. My dad is a policeman and he could not watch crime movies with us. Because the depiction of police work was just so incorrect in a way. And he just got so angry, especially because he wasn't the detective or anything. Like, he would wear a uniform. He was one of the people who are usually in the background just standing there and opening the door for the actual detectives. Like, how these guys are presented here, that's just not how they are. They're just like minions in uniform. He got so angry about it.
I completely understand that. Watching like CSI or whatever, I haven't done any what's it called when you
lab run work?
Lab work, like the crime lab work. Anyway, that word.
Forensics.
Mm. That's it. But I know that you can't just stick a vial in a centrifuge and a printer print out the subject's DNA. It's annoying.
That's a little bit more complicated.
A couple of steps. Anyway, yeah. I think I wonder how, if you came at it without a scientific background, whether it doesn't. Where it wouldn't in fact impact you as much.
I don't think it's necessarily a scientist thing. I think it's like all humans like kind of to understand the rules of something. And if you set it up in a way that is pretty clear what the rules are and you keep breaking them over and over, it's just not enjoyable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because like if it's used as sort of like a necessary thing for the plot, just to make sense of it, you're like, oh, like the way we wrote the story, kind of like there's no logic step from here to get from A to B, so we just sprinkle some like sci-fi magic in there to make it work.
Yeah.
And it sort of breaks all the initial rules. But I think that's not a scientist thing. I think
what's
it's just
with
storytelling,
what's with breaking physical rules, or at least some scientific rules, maybe not the fundamental laws of the universe, but breaking some rules of science and sticking to it, making them up as a premise that this is how things work here. For example, spaceships can make a hard stop in the middle of nowhere and just keep going again. That's not how space travel works or will ever work.
Yeah,
I think that's something I only learned quite recently, is that orbital mechanics are insanely important in these things. And that when you're a spaceship, you don't just stop and turn, take a turn right and take a turn left, but you kind of like use orbital momentum and the velocities from stars or planets or something like that.
Have you guys watched The Expanse?
Yeah.
No, I don't think I have.
So if you haven't, I can highly recommend it. It's
really
amazing. And I loved it because one of the things they get really right is how like moving in space in a spaceship actually works. Like, for example, one of the things we think, oh, we go to Mars, so it's like, oh, we like accelerate the whole way, or we accelerate once and then until we get there. But in reality, you like accelerate half the distance and then you decelerate the other half. Uh-huh. Because you've got to be at like zero velocity at your destination. So they have like a lot of the, like how traveling works is just very scientifically accurate. And that's not just my opinion, because I don't have any like knowledge about this. But like a lot of people say that it's like very well researched.
Okay, I didn't finish it. Maybe they missed that part, or I didn't get there. I just had the flattest characters I've ever seen.
I think
they're so undeveloped. That's why I didn't like it, not for the scientific part.
I mean, a lot of the rules have to be broken because of for narrative, like in an hour and a half movie, you can't have them decelerating or this sort of thing. And it's actually quite boring if you stick with the traditional rules of the universe. Or quite like mind bending, So like you were saying, the orbital mechanics, like actually zipping around the solar system, and like we would go to Mars, have a coffee, come back or whatever. It's like we'd have to think about where Mars is to plan our journey. It might take half an hour, but it might also take 3 days, depending on where Mars is in its orbit. Mm. And that you can't narratively, it's quite difficult to kind of sustain an accurate narrative. Mm. There's only, like, I really like some sci-fi books where they've taken it and kind of applied certain ideas in with the traditional limitations, and then it really messes with your mind. So there's a book about I forgot the name, but it's a war in space where they can travel at the speed of light, but the problems with time dilation while you travel the distances exists. So they send soldiers out there, and the soldiers are fighting battles. But by the time the soldiers return home, the whole civilization has collapsed and reformed again. And like, they couldn't tell their soldiers to stop fighting because they made peace originally. And so this is the whole confusion of these sorts of the problem. The space is so big, and you know, all these issues really do mess with our human perception of narrative causality.
Yeah, this is an example where the science in science fiction is part of the actual story.
I like that.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. There's this book I really liked, Seven Eves by Neil Stephenson. And the premise is that the moon gets destroyed somehow without any explanation. And what happens to the Earth after that, falling from the moon, exploding. And I don't want to spoil anything, but that's super cool. Just about orbital objects and how they behave with their orbits and how it affects us. Something that pisses me off a lot in movies is when they want to make some kind of superpower, something supernatural or super scientific, and they attempt an explanation, but then kind of stop halfway in consistency and just make it magic then, but with the scientific explanation. Or pseudo-scientific explanation, some kind of weird attempt. And this is something that annoys me a lot. I think when I first realized this, or I think the last time I got super angry about this was, I think it was some Iron Man movie, maybe part 3 or something. I don't know if you guys seen the Marvel movies and if you like them.
Yeah.
Which one was, what's the story in that
one? Is that the one where he makes a whole new element to power his suit again?
Wasn't that the first one?
No, I think that's the second.
Is that the second? There's one where he gets in front, he's on a beamline, and he's, he's moving the ray of ionizing particles, and then manages to make his element, and it's just he's so dead. There's so much radiation.
Okay, I wasn't talking about that. What I was talking about is that they were researching on some plant which had super good regenerative properties, and I think they excised some plant DNA, put it in humans, and all of a sudden they had superpowers where they could. I don't rely because it was many years ago when I watched it.
Iron Man movie?
I don't remember.
Wasn't it?
I'm pretty sure that's not Iron Man.
You're thinking of Groot. I mean, it did have regenerative properties.
So. The plant was just like a side note somewhere, which disappeared from our research laboratory, and the villains used it to make super soldiers, which I think could heat up their limbs because the plant would withstand fire or could regrow leaves after they got burned. And all of a sudden the humans, which had this DNA, which is of course already bollocks, but that's okay so far. But then they had properties beyond that. Like they had these super strong punches and could heat their... Did I dream that? Let's Google this now. I did not dream that.
Why are you having an argument with a fictional sci-fi movie that you dreamed up? No. Oh, man. This podcast is degenerated.
You must have the best dreams. When you dream of a whole Marvel
I am trilogy. This now.
Wait, is it branded Marvel as well in your dream?
I don't think I've ever heard of this.
Mm. If not, you've heard it here first. We should write the movie.
Lucky you. Yeah, exactly. Lucky you.
I think we have dibs on the film rights.
Yeah. I mean, the way you said it at the moment, I'm not 100% buying into the burn of, a plant that is non-combustible.
Mm. It's your language, man.
That was a confusing one.
But I think whenever they do
inflammable. Inflammable. Anyway.
Whenever they do some kind of genetic modifications, it's whenever there's super soldier a super soldier theme, I'm like, oh no, this is going to go horribly wrong. Like, because like common perception of how genetics works and what a super soldier is and how easy it is to monkey around with genetics is just so far off. And I think that might be due to like bad sci-fi that's like, oh yeah, you just like snip in something and boom, there you go. You like
take a fully grown human, like,
yeah, you take a rabbit and you take a human and boom, now the human can jump. You're like, that's not how any of this works. Like, we know enough about genetics that this does not work. Yeah. Like, we don't know enough about particle physics to actually say, oh, we might never travel faster than the speed of light or may never approach it.
But we don't know enough about it?
I don't think so.
I think people like, would want to agree here, like, but I'm not gonna.
We have like mathematics about wormholes and stuff. Like, there are at least some concepts that you could use that we don't know if they are viable or not, or like how much energy it would take. But I think with genetics, we know enough about like to actually get it somewhat right. I mean, come on.
I don't know. I think you've actually, because the whole CRISPR stuff has taken off and does allow it, like, say from whenever, what was it, we discussed it, was it 70s it first came out? But anyway, like, it's now CRISPR, allowing the 90s, editing that you just 90s. Talked about, like, easier than that. So maybe there's another thing we'll find at some point that will allow even easier editing of genomes that might lead you to. I think you're right, though. There's, like, fundamental things, like, where there's a fully grown super soldier, and they edit all of his genes, every single cell, however many trillion cells, everyone is edited precisely, and he turns into this...
Yeah, like West
Soldier
cancer,
Rabbit.
West Cancer Man.
Yeah, like, that's
technically, it's not out of reach. It's imaginable, right?
Okay. But the thing is, for example, like with that super soldier trope, it's like you think, oh, there's this dial and we're like at 4 and then you're just cranking up to 9 and now you're like super strong and stuff.
Which
and
it's is, like, oh, like, not... like in Lucy. Have you seen that?
Oh, Lucy is... Oh, I was so angry.
I just end up hating on sci-fi after all.
Yeah.
Didn't expect that.
I mean, it's not how it works. Like, you could go and maybe say, oh, if you want to have, like, super strength, we can, like, maybe change your muscles. But what you don't think about is, if you change the muscles, you have to change everything else as well. Like, how do you get enough energy in there? Like, why is it not getting, like, crazy, like, too much acid in the muscles? Like, what about the bones?
If the muscles grow, the bones just, everything snaps and the person falls to the floor in pain.
Like, people think, oh, it's, like, easy.
People can overdevelop one muscle and then it really does put pressure on the bones and, like, and mainly the tendons, I think.
Is it because you do it too fast and otherwise the muscle, like, for... a really strong person with a lot of muscle mass, which I think doesn't apply to any one of us.
Hey.
Sorry. You're ripped, bro.
I'm so ripped.
Does the bone have to keep up to compensate for the pull of the muscle once it's tense?
I mean, it does naturally, but if you'd use steroids or whatever, then the muscles can grow artificially strong. Too quickly, and then
the bone cannot keep up.
And the tendons
tendons, not the bone. I'm not sure if I buy into this. I would need some more proof of that.
But for example, if you have a seizure, or like there's like, what is it called? Like tetanus or something, where you get like spasms of the muscles, you basically break your own bones. Yeah. So like your muscles could do this. Just like in the way they are right now, if like everything goes terribly wrong. But if you grow your muscles to this insane strength, then that would happen for sure. Like, it's all of the... Like, it's not a dial. Like, the way we are is, like, already super fucking optimized.
Yeah.
Like, it's not... Like, we are not smart enough to go and be like, oh, stupid evolution, you should have just used this gene, and boom, you're, like, 100 EQ points smarter. That's not...
That is my... The trope I dislike the most is humans only use 10% of their brains or something, and then there's like so many movies where then they turn on the other 90%.
Lucy, for example, Morgan Freeman going, humans only use 20% of their brain, but what happens if we use 100%?
Yeah.
You would have a seizure. That's what you would have. You would have a seizure and you would die.
Okay, let's stay within the limits of let's stay within sci-fi, the realm of sci-fi, and say, okay, things can happen that might go beyond what is actually reasonable, in this case a seizure. And let's say we can get much smarter, much stronger, but what happened in Lucy is that her powers extended beyond the limits of her body, right? She would just like become one with the universe and stuff. This was not even like things that would not be affected by her brain at all of a sudden were like, first of all, her levitating. How can you do this with your brain? Like, even mechanically,
this movie is the best example for what I'm complaining about. Like, you make a premise, and then instead of following through with the premise, yeah, like every 5 minutes, you like turn up the dial and go, oh, she can understand like other languages. Look at how smart she is. And at some point she can like see what the cell phone radiation can like decode what the phones are sending into the sky.
Amazing.
And then she can time travel. Like, how is this in any kind of proportionate, like, what? You're like, and how did this all happen? Because she like ingested too much of a drug.
Yeah. Oh,
so nice. Ingesting too much of the drug makes you like a god. That, I mean,
in terms of like negative aspects to society, implying that you can take a drug to begin to levitate and decode masks, that might be a problem. But
yeah, for sure. I mean,
but the alternative that you're proposing is kind of a depressing story. If every like the super soldiers all get cancer, so there's just this montage of different test animals getting or test humans getting cancers, and then people who are just having seizures when they're trying to levitate.
I mean, I think it's still called science fiction, right? So the fiction part is relevant. And to some extent, scientific rules have to be broken for the narrative, for it to be interesting.
Yeah, but I think it's really personal preference. Like, some people really like Lucy and like they don't care about rules and they just enjoy the ride. And that's fine. That's just not the sci-fi that I enjoy.
I'm a bit jealous of that.
I think the really cool sci-fi for me like changes something super small and then just rides it out until the very end, and like all the implications, like what if there really were some people who could levitate, like what would that actually mean? Like getting it to the point where you're like, oh, UPS basically has no business anymore. Yay. Because it's run by levitating people and that would destroy the economy, like like all the super weird...
when the lift manufacturers shut down, yeah, the economy tanked.
Exactly. It's like you change a small thing and then you have a really close look at what that actually does. For example, in Halo, like we were talking about this, like I basically listened to the whole Halo series, like the books, and like one of the things they have in there is that you have these super soldiers, yes, but actually a lot of the people who enter the program die in the process. So like that's
realistic.
Why are you
obsessed with people getting cancer when they're turned into super soldiers?
They didn't only get cancer, they only get also get seizures.
Okay,
and stuff.
Good.
But
okay,
it's like
at least they had the seizures as well.
Like you have the super soldiers, but it's in a way where like, yeah, we couldn't really do that, but at least it's like a small set of rules that you bend.
Do you think because I completely agree with you, I want consistency and I like the exploration of a concept to its entirety, to the whole, like the whole implications of one, of something like that. That's my like favorite kind of sci-fi as well. But do you think because we do science and we suffer hard, because essentially as a scientist, you're using science fiction. You're saying, what if this could occur? Which hasn't already happened in the world. I'm going to see if I can make that happen. So you're create sort of like a future narrative, and then you try and attempt to get to that future narrative. So we struggle and suffer for that to every day. And so when we read science fiction where it's all like, it's super easy, we just do this and do that, we're a bit jealous of it. And that's why we can't read that kind of sci-fi, because we're like, that's bullshit. I work every day trying to do that and I still can't levitate.
For me, I think the moment when I felt like this was not with levitation, but I think the series was called Helix and I stopped at some point because I didn't enjoy it so much. But there's a scene in the beginning where they... Look at the DNA under the microscope and they see things, and then they look at the protein which is being expressed from that, and it's kind of mutated, and they just like literally put it up under the microscope and look at it and see, oh yeah, there's a mutation here and there. And I go like, that's what I've been trying to do for months now. Can you not just like, well, how can this be so fast?
Yeah. I suppose it's like, it's going back to your dad and seeing police procedural work.
Yeah.
For us, all of sci-fi. Science. Yeah.
And quick intermezzo here. I could not find anything that I've been talking about this Iron Man thing. I have no idea where this came from.
So I'm pretty sure it's not Iron Man, but if any one of the listeners figures out which movie Hannes is talking about, let us know.
Or they dreamed with Hannes this dream, this collective dream.
If you're inspired and a screenwriter, please contact me. I'm down.
But yeah, maybe you're right. I mean, I was just thinking about what eggs me on the most, and it's usually biology stuff, neuroscience stuff. I mean, I'm doing neuroscience, so if someone's like, oh yeah, no, we're just going to make people more intelligent, I'm like, maybe it just hits too close to home for me to enjoy.
What's so unreasonable about it? Couldn't there technically be a drug that makes us super intelligent?
There already are drugs that help cognition.
I don't know if we want to get into this discussion, but intelligence is a very difficult word in that context.
Yes.
Because there are some people who do amazing stuff. Like if you like certain forms of high functioning autism, where you like this guy looks at a city's like the skyline of New York and he just draws it out of memory. And you could say, oh, I mean, that's superhuman. That's like an ability that no one else has. But that comes at the cost of like other like severe deficits that he has in his like day-to-day life.
And you don't think there can be a version of a brain which has both? Just imagine it. Doesn't mean it can exist in our...
I think there could be one, but it's not as simple as putting in a drug. Because intelligence comes out of like how your synapses are wired and all of that structural stuff. For sure not as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
Because people talk about, oh, you want to have like super plastic brain so you can learn faster. But what that means is that you're like a teenager forever. Like everything would be super dramatic. All these changes, like everything would, like your personality would basically change on a week to week basis, which is not fun. It's not like, it's not a nice experience.
Wait. Teenagers' brains are different in a sense of plasticity.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly?
So plasticity basically means like how, if you think on a like really physical level, like how likely it is that the synaptic connections in your brain are going to change. Are you going to form new synaptic connections? Are you going to lose old ones? That's
plasticity.
Yes.
I've read this word so many times in conferences and talks and never knew what it's about. Thank you.
Yeah. So that's just what plasticity means. It's like how likely it is that connections in your brain will change. And if it's more dynamic, it's easier for you to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's less dynamic, you're more stable in your personality and your knowledge, which doesn't mean you can't learn like after a certain age, but it's definitely harder than before. But it also means that you as a person are pretty stable, which we all kind of like. That if I talk to you in a year, you're probably going to be like more or less the same person. And not like a completely different person. If you talk to someone who's 6 and then to someone who's 16, those are going to be very different people.
Also 10 years, not one. But I get your point.
I mean, 10 years.
That's really cool. I sort of vaguely knew about plasticity in terms of learning new actions and that sort of thing, but not in terms of your emotional state or your personality. And that's kind of cool that you would...
Yeah, I mean, it's all of it. Like, you would just start forgetting stuff because you're like okay, overriding is definitely the wrong term here because we're not a hard drive. But it's like, yeah, you don't want it to be too dynamic.
I think this is a great story, though, about a drug that caused people to revert back to a teenage self. So you have all these, like, 80-year-olds, like, super emotional, going out to parties and just, like, you know.
But you wouldn't say that teenagers are the smartest human beings on this planet. I mean...
Well, now that I've stopped being a teenager, yes. But when I was a teenager, I knew the most. I was the cleverest thing ever.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, how did we get on this trajectory? I think super soldiers. And, if there could be a drug that could increase your intelligence. I mean...
More like, is it impossible or is it within the realm of fiction? And I do think, for me, as a non-neuroscientist, as a neuro-non-scientist, that's okay.
I mean, if you have a drug that you would give children at a very young age for a long time, and on top of that,
in our universe,
in our universe,
think big, Philip, think big. Okay, I get your point,
we understand so little that it's really hard. Like, for example, people are saying, "Oh, you take Ritalin. What's the compound in it?"
I think the molecule is called Ritalin.
No, I think that's the brand name.
Yeah, what is Ritalin?
It's,
they're a drug.
It's like
they're
some kind of amphetamine.
Yeah.
Whatever, like what you, like basically what people with ADHD get as a prescription and what medicine students take to
finish the, yeah.
Learn more. And people say, oh, it makes you smarter or stuff. But in reality, it just makes you a lot more focused. Yeah. In theory. I don't know if that's like necessarily true.
It's called methylphenidate or phenidate. Is it German or English?
It's in German.
All right, sorry.
But either way, yeah. So this is not making you smarter at all. It's just like slightly changing your brain chemistry.
I mean, it's okay. Let's say the drug system might not work, but computer interfaces or whatever. Because we already are smarter. If let's say we're all allowed our smartphones with us, we are already smarter than the same sized brained human who didn't have a smartphone. Because we interface with the computer, it gets downloaded into our brains. It might be via our eyeball, but it's still downloaded into our brains. And we can, you know, map, communicate. We're becoming more cyborg-esque just by, you know, interacting with our computer systems.
There's actually a super, super fascinating concept, and it's the other way around. It's called extended cognition or something, or embodied cognition. So it's basically, instead of you keeping track of everything you have to do, you basically outsource part of your brain, let's say your brain processing, to your phone. I don't keep track of any of my events. My phone does that for me, so that brain capacity is basically free to do other stuff that I use, browsing YouTube and doing stupid shit. But in theory, you could argue that we are getting smarter because you can outsource stuff that your brain has to do.
Is that where this rant comes from that I've heard from you a few times now, when Leah, Philip's girlfriend, tells him things he doesn't care about, he gets angry because she's using up his brain capacity?
To some degree, yeah.
can you please quickly rant about that again? It's just so stupid.
I just get really annoyed if I get like random information about like, what is it? Like something like Heidi Klum's new boyfriend is like...
It's in your brain now.
Exactly.
It's like Tokyo Tel, in case you didn't know.
Now you've infected my brain with it, so I've lost cognition power.
He's like one of the... there was like this German band...
Tokyo Hotel.
Yeah, Tokyo Hotel. Like, I don't want to know this. Like, I'm going to know this for the rest... Hopefully not for the rest of my life. For a long time.
We keep reinforcing it, though.
You keep reminding me. It's like just... I don't want to know... I don't want to be exposed to all of this. And I mean...
Do you think it's a zero-sum game in that I know like when we sleep, we can begin to sort our short-term memories and stuff out and like take the important bits and try to move them into long-term storage and delete the bits that are, okay, we're not a hard drive, but, you know, eventually lose the bits that aren't important. But in your opinion, do you think it is, if we take on information that is useless, however you want to define that, we are wasting bits of our brain? Like all the cat videos I've ever watched is just my brain's filled with junk.
There are happiness in pictures. How is this junk? Now you're responsible. I'm sorry.
So I think we got to be a bit careful. Like I wouldn't say that all cat video, like all the time you spend watching
cat videos.
We're going to
get so much hate mail from cat lovers now. Oh, sorry.
It's useless. But
for the record, I do like cat videos. I think they're a benefit to society. I don't want to ban cat videos.
Don't budge to the cat overlords. No, I don't think it's a zero-sum game, but I do think like the stuff that you surround yourself with and the stuff that consumes shapes who you are. And I mean, I'm going on a rant, like a small thing, because I don't want to be annoyed by like some kind of gossip.
Heidi Klum's boyfriend has really got you angry and has changed your personality, because you've now ranted enough times for Hannes to be affected. And for now,
I just find it funny.
I think it's also like when I'm in a, let's say, mentally vulnerable state. So if you talk to me now, I'm like aware and I can reject sort of what you're saying. Like I'm like consciously processing what you're saying. But what Leah will do is, like, I'm doing something else, and she kind of, like, stands behind me and starts talking to me. So it's not, I'm consciously, actively doing something else, and it just seeps into my mind. And I think it's almost like ads you get on your phone. It's like you do something else, and it just kind of seeps in. It's like really, I don't know.
Okay, I would like to do two things right now. I would like to open the second beer, and I would like to bring the conversation back to sci-fi, because we kind of went off topic here.
No, I think we should start this as a relationship counseling podcast where we talk about such topics as,
if you want to see me driving,
trying to influence my brain subliminally.
No, I think we should stop, else I'm going to sleep on the couch for the next 100 years.
Wait, that's not for you. That's not for you. Sorry. Mm-hmm. What are we actually having here? For you, I bought a Mexican Pilsner. I hope you like it. And what did you buy, Chris?
Knitknapperen. No?
Yeah, sure. Can you say it again?
Knitknapperen. Knitknapperen.
I would say, but also my Swedish isn't very good.
Cool. That's another bit of my brain just wasted.
I cannot even... This does not work in any kind of Swedish pronunciation.
Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh. That's from Matrix, is it not? Yeah.
I think it's actually...
It's the size of a champagne.
I guess the name is from something else, right?
Yeah, I think it's a planet or something. Or a star.
No, Nebuchadnezzar is a size of a champagne bottle. You know how you've got like...
A size?
A size of champagne bottle. So you've got a normal bottle, and then you've got... I can't remember. It's going to be like, this size.
Is it between a Magnum and a...
But you get a Balthasar and a Nebuchadnezzar, and they're like 20 champagne bottles, 30 champagne bottles, and they're the size of a human. They're pretty...
But is it the original name, or did they sort of get it from somewhere else?
I don't know.
And the name of the bottle shape was actually inspired by a number of Babylonian kings mentioned in the Bible. And apparently there's no relation to any stellar object, planet, star, whatsoever.
But that's a good name for a beer, I mean...
Yeah. Okay, we did not follow my second wish to get back to sci-fi, though.
No, we can. So I have a question.
Yes.
Like, what's the sci-fi that you feel like has influenced you the most? I don't know, that's a tough question, but...
Books.
Let's stick with books, not shows and...
Cheers. And we'll stick with sci-fi for the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Then for me, it's, I've forgotten his name. This is awful. The culture novels by Ian M. Banks.
Yeah. I've heard so much about them and I haven't read a single one.
They are a lot of old sci-fi, the kind of Philip K. Dick era sci-fi is quite dystopian. Like, the effect of technology is a negative on society, and there's something we need to learn about ourselves from... There's a moral narrative to the book.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there is some moral message within the culture series. He's got other ones not based in the same universe, but mainly it is an example of a society that has progressed so far in science and technology that all of the problems... that we currently encounter, like war, like famine, like they can just make anything. They have not unlimited sources of energy, but they tap stars for energy. So it's solved. They can print anything. They can regrow body parts and this sort of thing. And it explores what the problems of such a society would have. And I really like it. It's both uplifting. It's kind of the thing I'm aiming for by doing science. But also it's kind of interesting seeing how, you know, ideas like if humans have nothing to work for, they get bored and actually get kind of depressed and, you know, then spend a lot of time coming up with stupid hobbies or dangerous things to get themselves injured because they, you know, have nothing to worry about. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a nice concept. It also looks at how that society would interact with lower societies and like less well-developed societies. And so it has a moral message in terms of like imperialism and that sort of thing. But I love it. I think it's a great...
Yeah, awesome. Maybe that's my reading project for this year.
Cool.
I think when I was reading much more than the last 10 years, so as a child and teenager, I was mainly reading fantasy books, not so much sci-fi. So there I haven't been influenced so much by sci-fi. Later on, I did enjoy Neil Stephenson a lot. Just because science fiction is very accurate scientifically, and I did enjoy this very much. There's especially the book Anathem.
So what is it about?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
It just got stuck in my head. It was that good, it completely blanked your mind. You're like, oh my God. I just started remembering the whole thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it's basically about a society... which is very advanced, and science has led to collapse of society or near collapse of society several times. So I think three times, and they kind of explain the technologies responsible. The first one was, I think, nuclear fission, and the other ones are something we didn't achieve yet. Yeah, like something they talk about is elemental synthesis, where they can make new elements with new properties. Well, and in the end, the scientists now are basically held in monasteries, and they can only get out every now and then at different levels, depending on...
Wait, that's exactly how it works these days at the moment. We're literally doing this inside our institute at the moment.
There's no
we have very limited access to
in the book, there's no communication from the scientists to the public ever. Like, there's a physical border, but also they have no way of internet, no internet or anything like that. So they can only... So you can enter this institution for a certain amount of time. There's the option of, like, a year, 10 years, 100 years, or 1,000 years. Of course, people don't get that old, but, like, the gates to the 1,000-year monastery only opens every 1,000 years. So it's basically only babies who live there and die in there. And every 1,000 years, people open their gates and talk to other people. I'm not sure about the details anymore. It's also not so important. What I found super interesting is this insane distrust in science, because it has led to horrible events in society, while at the same time also society still uses most technology developed by these scientists, just now in a less harmful way. I think this kind of showed where the relationship between society and science can go in the most extreme, and that's probably what I enjoyed about it the most.
Did the society think of the science that they had been given as magic? Because I hear a lot of that's the what's the classic quote: any sufficiently advanced technology is tantamount to magic.
I don't know. How it was phrased in the book. I don't know anymore. The entire book centered almost exclusively around the scientists.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was interesting because people were still using these technologies. Nuclear synthesis, I think they called it, and so they were super advanced. But at the same time, all these ideas of scientists, new things were completely opposed. Like, people did not trust any new technologies from these scientists anymore. And then the science they did was very basic again, because they didn't really get funding. So they mainly used their minds and a blackboard. So they didn't develop a lot of stuff anymore.
Cool. Oh, interesting.
So how about for you?
Yeah, I mean, I posed the question, now I don't have a really good answer, but I think I really enjoyed Dune. I don't know if you've read it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if
I started, didn't finish it.
Fantasy or sci-fi, but I think it has a big sci-fi component. And it's just like looking, so you have this planet and he's looking at the ecology as this whole system. And you could all, yeah, it's like systems biology or something.
I'm kind of tempted to stop you right there because I still do want to read it. But
so, I'm not going to spoil anything.
There's so many levels of complexity within it, which I really like. There's the sci-fi, like it's a crazy world and we can explore it and these sorts of things. But I have a friend who, he studied history and he studied the, at one point he was studying the expansion of Islamic, of the caliphates in the Middle East and these sorts of things in originally with Muhammad and then with the successive prophets. And that's a big theme within Dune. And he even co-opts some of the language of Islam for it. But the, like that era, and he looked at it from a historical perspective and a sort of like, cultural anthropological perspective. And he liked the book as well, because it talked to him to the areas that he'd studied, and it had that kind of, historical anthropology fiction, as we have science fiction for us.
That's so interesting.
And he really enjoyed it from that side of things. And it's so good.
It's just amazing. And I just catch myself, like, one important thing that sci-fi can do for us is, I think, just exposing you to, like, how do you say it? Like, mind experiments? No. Thought experiments. Yeah. Thought experiments in a very entertaining way. But what you take away is not necessarily the entertainment, but the thought experiment and the the ideas and the concepts that kind of emerge from this thought experiment. And for Dune, it's a lot about, I don't know, how time works and like just having a very concrete way of thinking about how like parallel strands of possibilities work at the same time. And yeah, I mean, I don't want to spoil too much, but it's just, I find myself coming back to that, just that concept. And it's just, I don't know, sci-fi is super powerful in that regard, that it opens up all of these avenues and ways to think about the world.
It's probably in the top 10 things I would like to take from something to have from a sci-fi novel is to try spice and see what. The description of the taste is amazing, but also whatever it does, that sort of stuff is kind of interesting as well.
Yeah, I think we need to change the topic.
Yeah, and Hannes is shaking his head now. He's lost it. So.
I mean, we could do a whole episode about Dune. And I tried to read the second book, and I read that the second one is the hardest to kind of read. Have you read
I think I've gone through the first four. I kind of gave up when his son started writing the series after him. Then it gets a bit much.
But yeah, so I tried to read the second one. It's the second time I tried during my vacation, and I'm like halfway through, and I feel like the first time I got like to 30%, and now I got to like 50-60%. So yeah, I need another vacation to get like through the whole thing. But yeah.
Just to kind of change, well, move slightly towards fantasy rather than science fiction, because a lot of the things we've been talking about, like consistency and stuff like that, that really make you not like science fiction, I have the same problems with fantasy. But like, hands down, the universe that has affected my thinking throughout the whole time is the Discworld, the Terry Pratchett's Discworld series. And his like slightly irreverent look at an alternative fantasy universe of mirroring our own is brilliant. It makes you into such a like sarcastic, kind of cynical person by the end of it. It's a really good training for the modern world and this sort of thing. So it's awesome. But he writes his fantasy with inherent rules within it, so that magic is constrained by the laws of kind of conservation of energy and this sort of thing. And it's one of my biggest, like, we don't have to get into this, but I have real problems with Harry Potter because of the lack of consistency of the amount of energy they can produce with their wands. Like, where are they getting this energy from? They can kill people, or they can levitate like a tiny feather, and there's no explanation why they can't just levitate a building or whatever.
But that's actually, so I'm subscribed to this YouTube channel, and I can't remember the name right now, sorry. But he basically has this really nice YouTube video about soft magic versus hard magic. And he basically, so depending on what kind of magic you want to do, you have like the hard magic that's like similar to the first thing you were describing. There are like hard rules, and there's like laws of energy conservation and stuff like that. But you can always also have like soft magic, and interestingly, the soft magic usually doesn't have like a physical component, but a like character component. So you can do more if you as a person basically develop. So Harry Potter can't do that much in the first book, but in the end he's more powerful, and it's because of character development and about like the control he has over his own.
I think the Lord of the Rings is a good example for soft magic, where there's no rules ever described and people can do things, and they might only do them once, or they do them without you expecting anything of this, and it might change, like might come out of the blue. But in the end, it's tightly bound to their character. Like Gandalf's magic, at some point, he wields his staff and lights shining from it, and this just happens, right? And Sauron as this ultimate evil who has evil powers with the ring, who also never described of how this works and why and so on.
There's more of a narrative rule that you follow to write good.
Yeah.
Whatever. Just if people feel better if characters develop and become all powerful over time, rather than just being instantly all powerful that it narratively is kind of off-putting if there's a baby wielding the Avacadavra spell from in it, like,
isn't that exactly what happened in Harry Potter?
Well, you're gonna
cast the spell,
kind of, but no. The power of love solves everything.
Now right. We're gonna get a lot of fan mail.
Oh Jesus!
Like, I did
just not the burning the cat loving Harry Potter fans are gonna absolutely flame this podcast.
I'm sorry.
I really liked Harry Potter, but just in terms of the like breaking the, I suppose it's like breaking the science third wall or fourth wall or whatever for me, just completely takes me out of the narrative if there's something glaring like, wait, how did you do that? Why do you get this?
But I think it's just a different source of where that magic is coming from. So I don't think it's just a plot device, but it's like, if you think about, I mean, it really depends on the book and whatever, but the soft magic that I enjoy sort of binds the magic to like your control over, for example, your own emotions or something. It's like you have this magic as chaos, and somehow if you learn how to control that chaos, if that might that be like, for example, your own emotions, like if you're angry, you can't do crazy magic, but if you like learn how to control yourself, you can like muster more powerful spells or stuff like that. I think it's in that sense not too far from like sci-fi. It's like you have, as long as you have a rule, and like also sci-fi comes from some place, right? It's like, oh, you have this technology, and then this technology magically gives you the opportunity to like fly faster than like the speed of light or something like that. And it's not explained how that works, but it's like, this is the source where that power, quote unquote, comes from. And in magic, it's the same. It's like, oh yeah, you can levitate stuff, but you got to learn how to control, or you need to know the words or whatever, like whatever it is.
Yeah. Because there's a point in the Harry Potter books where all holds barred, they just learn loads of spells without the effort that it required in the first series of books where they were spending so long. At some point, he just starts killing people and you're like, oh, that was cool. Harry, we thought you were nice, but no, he's just out there.
How do you guys feel about zombies? Is it more fantasy or more science fiction? Because they have been around for a long time, technically.
I feel like they've moved. I feel like they've moved from fantasy to sci-fi to some degree. Because it's like the spin on them nowadays is like, oh, it's a virus, and that explains, oh, it increases their body temperature, and that's why they need brains. However that works, I don't know. But like,
they don't need blood and oxygen anymore, right?
Yeah, I think I might like the older zombie movies more because they are just like straight up saying, this is magic, we don't have to explain this, than like trying too hard to make the science work and figuring out, oh yeah, the science will never work.
I think this might be one of the few examples where science has impinged on the fiction rather than the other way, like has affected the fiction rather than the other way around, because there are examples in nature of these fungi that take control of the like brain stems of ants, I think some insect.
I think it's something with C. I think it's
ant corvettes. Is with A.
What is it called? It's something. This is gonna.
Yes. Yeah. So this one, and it gets the ant, which is now dead, to like crawl up.
Is not dead, right? Okay. Otherwise, it couldn't crawl. Well, then it controls. Like,
I mean,
some,
it's definitely brain dead at that point.
Is a zombie dead? Oh, it's undead. Okay, so the ant is undead, and it goes up the tree, and then when it gets to the right height, or a height, the fungus fruits and goes up through its brain, and then a little mushroom head appears, and then the spore's released, and it goes on and infects more ants.
I heard of different...
Cordyceps.
And fungus, which makes the ant climb up some grass. And deer is then eaten with the grass by deer or something, and the fungus actually does want to get into the deer.
So I've heard a
you're different... talking about the same thing, but it's a bird, and you're right, it climbs up a plant, could be some grass.
Who's a bird? Oh, it should be eaten by a bird, not by a deer.
Correct. So you're both... Okay, Hannes is sort of wrong.
So to take this idea from ants, right, there is a parasite that lives in rats. And cats, and it affects the brains of rats. So it causes the rats to lose their fear inhibition, and people don't really know, but they seem to be maybe attracted, I'm not really sure about any of this, to the smell of cat urine and this sort of thing. And the idea for this is, well, the reason the parasite does this is so it can get eaten by a cat. It then does part of its life cycle in the cat gut, then gets excreted by the cat, then rats get reinfected, and then the rat has to get back to the cat for the cycle to propagate. And this has been implicated in that humans can get this parasite, although they don't know the effects it has on the brain. Although this is like, the myth is that this causes crazy cat lady like things, that humans would become overly attracted to cats and so on and so forth. That's not scientific in any way. This is just like pop science.
Is that why you're into cat videos?
Well, yeah, because it's hygienic. I don't want to be infected. I just like watching.
I'm infected,
and that's why I like cat videos.
Yeah, I think you are.
Oh. Yeah, the parasite is called Toxoplasma gondii. And there's like a couple of studies on humans, but there's actually no big effects. Like,
you didn't even have to Google it. You knew that.
I had to Google the name.
I saw him Google.
But on one of my favorite podcasts, they actually talked about this.
Okay,
cool.
Just today. But
back to zombies.
You are a zombie at that point, right? The rat has become a zombie.
Well, but no, okay, so you were saying it inspired older zombie narratives and kind of
moved away from
scientificized. And well, I guess I think zombies, the idea of a zombie comes from people not really being dead. What's this called in English? When a person seems dead, they don't really have a breath anymore and barely a heartbeat. Kind of like a coma. Let's just go for coma. And so they come back to life while people are still mourning them in their bed still, like after a day or two or three. And so they think they're undead and they're evil, so they knock them over the head and kill them for good.
Is this a historical fact?
I think that's where this zombie myth comes from.
In the Victorian times, they were super obsessed with all of this, to the extent that they had little devices in the coffins with a string and a bell on the top, because I don't think they were worried about the undead coming to kill them, but they were all worried that they would be buried alive themselves, and that they wanted to be able to alert people that they were. Hugely common. Like, surprisingly, it was like a whole, like the whole society just got really worried about this thing and, you know, did it. Like,
but if you look at the quality of the medicine at the time, I think that's a very reasonable fear, to be honest. I mean, they didn't have any, like, they couldn't check the heartbeat in any precise way.
Can we stay on topic for a second? So, is that where, let's just assume that's where zombies came from. And then there are stories of, like, these necromancer bring the dead back to life. I guess that's where the fantasy zombies come from, because can someone turn the lights back on? That's weird.
That's kind of creepy that the lights
are on. I think, because we were in the meeting room for a certain amount of time and this time has passed. But yes, now we've been talking for an hour. so then zombies are definitely fantasy, but who said that? One of you? Now they're more sci-fi, because now there's this scientific explanation, and some stories play with this a lot, where they try to find the cure and actually investigate what is the virus or bacterium, whatever it is, what are they doing, how does it affect the physiology of the undead kind of alive human still, why do they crave brains, or whatever they crave, might just be human flesh or...
And I mean, it's also like the storylines of the whole thing changed. When you look at like old zombie movies, it's a lot about survival. And I think, what's like the Day of the Dead, where they're in the mall? Have you ever watched that one?
Yeah.
This is about consumerism and how like basically capitalism is turning people into zombies. That's the story of the whole thing. But if you watch a modern zombie movie, it's a lot usually about finding the cure, which is like a very scientific concept in the first place, right? It's a virus, we need to find the antidote, and then we can make everything great again. I don't think it's about capitalism and consumerism anymore. It's about...
No, that capitalism won that, didn't it?
So one thing I never really got is zombies do want to eat humans. But if you kind of escape and get away with a scratch or a bite, you turn into a zombie yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But when they eat half of you, you don't necessarily.
Well, you die.
So, yeah, you die, but when they just scratch you, you don't. And it's always been a bit of a mystery how zombies, how most people end up being zombies if what they do mostly is just eat people all the way, all together.
There's a, I can't remember the, is it called Pandemic? No, that's a game. There's a movie where it's a zombie movie, but it's much more about the epidemiology of the infection moving through the population, and like, you know, islands and stuff would survive because they're obviously, there are no zombies going to get to the island.
Is it Contagion?
Contagion. Are there zombies in Contagion, or is it just a flu?
Oh, it might be just a flu.
Okay, it's the title.
Contagion.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I would want to watch that movie.
It was cool, yeah.
But
there's also World War...
I think they're borrowing from the rabies survivors, because if you have rabies, you'll get like bitten by a dog, and then that infects your brain, and like the symptoms in dogs or other animals might be they are not afraid, they are more aggressive, they bite you and that kind of stuff. So like if you have like a tame zombie, might be the same as what you would describe in a rabies infected dog.
If the virus wanted to spread, he would make the zombie scratch or bite everyone.
Which is what rabies does.
Yeah, not kill them, not eat them, right? If the virus wants to spread.
But this is...
Well, I mean, the eating is really weird in the first place.
But this is the problem with diseases. So like, not problem with disease, but the dichotomy that what we call the bacteria or infectious agents that are classified as us, as diseases, do you kill the host quickly, in which case you can't spread really efficiently, or do you kind of leave the host to be okay but go around infecting loads of people?
Mm-hmm.
Like Ebola is like, it's a terrible, terrible disease, but in one respect it's too deadly. The host dies too quickly to infect the next set of people. So it's not spreading as widely as, say, SARS or something like that, where the host has got SARS but wanders around and infects hundreds of people on a plane.
But that's actually, like, if you have a zombie movie, I think that's sort of scientifically accurate. Because what happens in these cases with, like, Ebola and stuff, where it's, like, super deadly for the host, it jumps from, for example, from one species to another. So the virus or the pathogen that you have is not very well adapted to the host, and that's why the incidence of death is so high. So it jumps like a species, and it's super adapted to that initial species, but it's very poorly adapted to humans, and that's why people are, for example, really afraid that bird flu is skipping over to humans, because the initial death rates would be super high.
Mm.
And then it would like taper off because the virus kind of adapts to the host. And it would be like more like a normal flu. Yeah,
I think apparently Ebola's doing this now. There's less; it's becoming less deadly. And
I mean, from the virus standpoint, that makes a lot of sense. So if you think about a zombie epidemic, it would basically be the initial step.
Is the eating?
Is the full consumption crazy?
And then it would go to scratching.
Okay,
exactly. Yeah, it would kind of taper off and not be as bad anymore.
Huh. I gotta go pee quickly. You guys can keep talking about zombies, and then I would like to talk about the societal impact of, or the impact of science fiction on how societies see science and what they expect from us and what they maybe fear. But for now, you keep talking about zombies.
We should just do an episode on zombies. We just totally take apart.
I don't know. There's a lot of research involved in zombies, because you have to figure out, I don't know, there are so many crazy concepts with the whole thing. Like, why do they only eat brains? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, where did the brain thing come from? I think zombies now in movies have moved away from the brains thing. They're much more just, like, hard to kill and diseased.
But it's like none, like, from a scientific standpoint, like, yeah, you can go the virus route. But in reality, you could just, like, it makes more sense to do like a movie about like a flu epidemic where a lot of people die, and
the toxoplasmodium causing people to watch cat videos. I think that's,
for example,
that's
the whole society breaks down.
And then it's a whole thing about our addiction to technology and like looking at Twitter the whole time, and that's how we all become zombies.
Yeah, but I think it's just like the part where they don't die, or they like they don't have to eat. Then you're in that territory of energy conservation. Like if you, if you move, you have to get your energy from somewhere. If you like your if your body starts decomposing, like there's just no way you're gonna be doing anything. Like your whole body just shuts down and that's it.
I mean, in terms of like if you take one rule and then apply it to the two things, it's like if you accept that souls exist and are can animate things and haunt things and this sort of thing, then then the whole concepts change again, and you're like looking at ghosts and zombies and you know these sorts of things.
Where... Yeah, but then you're. I mean, I think that might be more like the, let's say, last decade or two decades ago zombie concept. Like if you have like a science, I don't think you can have like oh it's a virus and then bring a soul into that whole thing, because soul is not a very nice scientific concept to work with.
It tends to be though that that's the end point for a lot of these movies, like love or like human interaction solves the big solves the big science problem, that something about humans is unique that allows them to solve the problem, and it's usually love, let's be honest.
But I really like zombie movies, I have to say, and the reason is not because of the scientific concepts, because it's like so far out I don't even care anymore, but it's like I think zombie movies and horror movies in general say something very interesting about the society and like the problems it tackles. I think that's in horror movies quite obvious, like for example that in whatever, if you look at older horror movies, like the first person who dies is like the black guy, or the last person that survives is like the one girl that did not participate in all the sleeping around and drinking beer. It's like the nice girl from the neighborhood, and she beats the monster, whatever it might be. So that's like a more, that's a moral statement. If you're a nice girl and you behave yourself, then you're going to survive and everything is going to be fine. So I think horror movies make this very clear in a way that other movies don't. Like you can see all the biases of society in horror movies.
What did we drift off to?
Just how great zombie movies are and how they are the window onto a society's soul.
Oh, wow, good. It's very deep.
Cool. Are we going to now talk about the effect of movies on society?
Go for it. Okay, I'm going to start with this. I took some extra curricular course in my studies, something cultural sciences about, I don't know, man and machine or something, whatever. And I had the impression that the teacher of this course had implied a lot that fiction movies, the example was Frankenstein, for example, was more like a prediction, was almost driving science in these directions. And I'm sure everyone here disagrees with this a lot. That's not why we do science. You're shaking your head, Chris. You just provoked me. Come on.
I think I disagree with that. Yeah.
Go for it.
I think, like I said, like we are somewhat science. We somewhat imply science fiction every day, where we say, I would like the world to work in a certain way. I'm going to see if it does work in that way. I'd like to create a technology that does this thing.
And in incremental steps.
Yeah,
even in,
but then I think science
on a daily basis.
So science fiction does encourage us to strive for something better, faster than light travel.
I don't think these ideas come from science fiction. I think they come from people who want to know these things based on the real world, not based on fiction.
No, I mean, like, so space travel. Let's say, right? We now can travel to space. But in Victorian times, there are these science fiction novels about guys going, "Oh, I wonder what would happen if I attach too many balloons to my house," you know, and then they look and they go off to the moon and it's made of cheese or whatever, you know, they travel around and these sorts of things. And that inspires people to think, well, actually, I would like to go to the moon. Like, the moon isn't just a representation of my God. The moon is something.
I don't think that's how it went down, but I am okay if we disagree on this.
Okay.
That's fine with me.
But I think the bigger effect of sci-fi on society is not that it creates scientists or inspires young people to go into science. I think it's more maybe the fact that you accustom people to the idea of certain things. So for example, AI and like the robot apocalypse and all of that kind of stuff, I think shapes definitely the public discussion about like actual current AI research that we have. I think sci-fi has a lot of influence of how we talk about as a society about certain issues that scientists themselves don't even have. Like, these films are not made by AI scientists, but by some guy in Silicon Valley. No, not even Silicon Valley, like Los Angeles, going, I wonder what would happen if I could find an AI bot, and what would that mean for society? What is it, like Ex Machina or something?
Watch it, but this is the second time now you make me flag a podcast.
That's like
explicit.
A 15-year-old movie.
That's not what I mean. Also, last time you said fucking at some point, now I have to flag it explicit.
Yeah, just duck me out, man. I can give you like the duck the every time I say it, it's like
how would you just edit the podcast and then you can do it?
Okay.
Awesome.
So are you saying that's a positive aspect or a negative aspect?
I don't know. I think it's just society coming to grips with these issues and just thinking ahead.
Do you think it fuels fear? Sci-fi, because often science is in some way the bad guy, or at least leads to a lot of issues for the main characters. Do you think it in the end fuels fears?
I think overall it's neutral. Like, if you look at, for example, what was it? Was it like Star Trek where they had the, what is it called?
Tricorder,
yeah, basically like a smartphone, which was like oh my god, they can just call, and we're like, I don't know, I have like this
do you think this sparked the development of smartphones? That's what people think. Isn't that interesting if we could just hold the telephone in our hands? They think this can be attributed to Star Trek.
I mean, already, no, I think someone held a telephone in their hand with a cord on it and were like, it would be better without this cord. And then they wrote Star Trek, being like, you know, how would I take this into the future?
I was just teasing you. But something I find very interesting to watch is how screenwriters or authors in the past imagined the future to be. I think a good example is in 1984, ignoring this dystopian society, only the... What was the technology they had to transform speech into writing? There was a device that would move a pen for you, because the concept of computers was still so far away. Yeah. It was still this advanced future would still depend on paper. And then what was it? Some space travel movie where they could not imagine having flat screens. Every screen was still like this gigantic electron tube. It's just interesting how some things were still there in their perception.
I think that the example of the smartphone in science fiction is a good one of certainly like a negative aspect to non-scientists of science fiction and science's progress. So if someone watched Star Trek and saw that when they were a kid and they saw the thing, and then now they have a smartphone, their perception of how technology advances is, oh, it's quite easy. Like, you have to put a little bit of effort in. It takes 10 years, and then we have a smartphone. And the implication from that is, in Star Trek, they had a teleporter, but we don't have a teleporter now in 10 years after the effect. So are scientists putting enough effort in for this thing? Or is the government suppressing the teleporters that they have, but they're not telling us about? Or, you know, because it doesn't give any implication as to the difficulties of one technology over another. It just implies that all technology is available at all times. And I think that's kind of difficult when you talk to people about what we do and this sort of thing. Like, so it's like, oh, well, we have vaccines for TB. So why can't we have a vaccine for cancer? Like, yeah. Well, I mean, yes, but it's hard. Cancer's difficult and more complex. And it does make people distrust scientists in a way. I think this is going to be inherent. I don't think there's any way around this problem. But it's just that it does, if you don't know the difficulties or the difficulties aren't explained to someone, then, you know, it does affect people's perception of science, probably in a negative way.
You can hardly blame fiction writers for that. I don't think that's what you wanted to do.
No, that makes us, makes people slightly less trustful of society or whatever.
Yeah.
you know, it's funny, like, Back to the Future, where the things they predicted and the things that didn't. So, like, they didn't predict the internet, but they predicted hoverboards. Now, we do have a hoverboard, but it's a bit shit. You have to pour liquid nitrogen into it, and it has to be a metal surface or something like that.
You can do it, but
it's just, like, really terrible. And on the surface, there's no reason why one or the other. I mean, actually, we're kind of getting there now with the drone stuff. The batteries have got light enough now that you can have these jetpacks or drones and stuff. So we're getting closer, but yeah.
But yeah, I would, like, just thinking about the smartphone, like, if you would have talked to scientists at the time and would have let them rank, like, oh, is everybody going to have a teleporter in, like, 15 years? Or is everybody going to have a smartphone? Like, what their answer would have been.
Mm-hmm. What would they do with the smartphone? Would they actually call people with them? Or would they mainly watch
cat videos?
Cat videos and porn.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think they imagined the right kind of... But that's features of these technologies.
Like, all of this is so complex, and
it's unforeseeable also, right?
Exactly.
But it's also about what is monetizable. So, like, you know, whether there's a market for it or these sorts of things. So some technologies have been left orphaned for so long until they can find a way to sell it or to that consumers would like it. Like, that's that's another sort of thing that stops the development or the translation of these technologies.
But, like, for example, I think sci-fi is important in the sense that it at least thinks about the implications before we actually get to the point where we have them. Because we, as scientists, we move as fast as we can, or let's say
as slow as we can,
where we get the funding for, but you don't think of the ethical implications of AI until you're actually at a point where you get, like, a Skynet situation. You're like, oh, sorry, I was just doing research on, like, general AI, and now we have the super smart being. What does that mean? But, like, sci-fi already does that. If you think about transporters from, like, the Star Trek model, sounds super neat, right? You would want to do it. But what it actually means is that you step on this device, it incinerates your body, and then it recreates your body somewhere else. So you die in the process of being transported, which, it's basically
again, where does the mass come from? Where does the mass come from?
Well, it recreates the mass at the other. Yeah, like, it uses, it has so like it a has mass a
storage. Yeah, it has a storage device for mass, but it means it can only transport.
Right? Yeah,
it can only transport.
It's a microtome that goes across, cuts you through, and then 3D prints you on the other side.
Yeah, exactly. A certain teleporter can only create a certain amount of people until you have to refill the tank or something.
Yeah, with stem cells. Yeah. This teleporter only works cells, with humans.
It's like on a molecular level. It's like atoms. It's basically like
a big tank of atoms. So you're the tank of atoms.
So you basically print a liquid, because we are liquid, right? Most of us is.
Well, I mean,
sure, yeah.
Liquid doesn't even matter if you're printing on atomic level. I mean,
it's like a big.
It's going to move as soon as you print it. How do you want to stop the molecules from moving?
If you can print on atom level, I think the temperature of each atom is not going to be the problem that.
We can cool the atoms.
But yeah, what I'm saying is, like, it gives you this playground to kind of get acquainted with an idea of what it would actually mean. And I think you're absolutely right that the moment you get it, like, the implications are, like, widely different from what you actually expected, like watching cat videos all the time, for example. But at least you have a playground to kind of, you know, test it out, like, what's happening.
I wonder what the most accurate sci-fi in, like, visualization of a technology and how it was going to be used. Who got it perfectly right when that technology...
Which Black Mirror episode is actually going to be the future?
Well, in the UK versions of Black Mirror, the politician...
The very first episode.
Yeah, sex with a pig. And that actually...
Didn't that happen last year? No.
for legal reasons, we can't say, but look up a certain UK politician and a pig, and you will find out.
Mm.
Genuinely.
But I'm wondering...
That was the rumour, but anyway.
But I'm wondering if they already knew about it, and that's why they made the episode, or if they really just came up with it. But Black Mirror is so good at, like... That's such amazing sci-fi. Like, not like the later seasons, maybe not so much, but like first and second season, like in the beginning, they were so good at what they were doing. Just like taking this concept, changing just something small and just playing out, like, what would be
the worst case, what's going to happen?
Not even worst case, well, it's just like the absurdity. And like I'm pretty sure if you would go 100 years back, take someone, put him here, he would look at us and just be horrified by what we're doing. And it's fine for us to...
just so much porn on the internet, guys. What the hell?
Like, all kinds of things. Like, you... That's just, like, how people are connected. And just, like, we don't appreciate that I can call someone, like, wherever, whenever. It basically costs nothing.
And at the same time, you would never, but you'd rather send a text and leave them on read for 2 days.
Yeah, for example. But even then, even if I call someone, I'm going to be like, oh, the connection was so terrible. WhatsApp and Australia doesn't work well together. Like, I had this half a second delay.
He's so angry.
Yeah, and you get really angry about it. And then you have this person going like, what did you just do? It's just like, I don't know.
That never happened
weird.
In Star Trek. They never, well, I mean, actually, the teleporters did break down quite frequently, but they never had them like raging at the teleporters being like, what is this kind of delay? A millisecond. This is bullshit. I can't even deal with this. And like, yeah.
I mean, how can you imagine like a lag situation on a teleporter? Do you just then miss just slices of your body? Or how would that work? Yeah. It's like, oh no, again, I forgot to print my right wrist and I'm stuck with only one hand here.
Scotty, give me my wrist back.
I think if there's an error, you're just going to be dead. Like,
are you sure they don't save like a template? So worst case, if something goes wrong, they can shoot and print a new one.
Okay, but then you're just in cloning territory there.
But
I think teleporting is one of the weirdest and most scary technology. I think
what you described before was basically cloning.
No, I think there's a good reason that the governments are suppressing that technology and keeping it for
Stop
themselves.
Stop saying it. We'll get this podcast taken down. Oh.
No, so in the basement in this building, there's this department, super secret, and they actually cloned someone to the campus on the other side of town recently.
Hmm.
Teleported it.
But it took
It
took probably about 30 years, right?
Okay, so we end the podcast, or?
Yeah. Now we're just moving into our own science fiction podcast. Yeah.
Let's call it a day and have no outro. Want to go climbing, Chris?
Yeah.
Did you want to sing the outro music?
Yeah, because then it's called royalty free. So.
Is it true?
Well, yeah. If I sing, I'm going to sing a famous song because otherwise I get sued.
I think you can sing it.
Oh, sure.
No, if I sing it, then I get sued by Rihanna or whatever.
I think you can cover songs without having pay royalties.
No, you can't. You have to pay.
I think if you cover,
you have to pay, definitely.
Are you sure?
To a songwriter, yeah.
What if you change the tune? Yeah.
Wait.
I think you have to change it enough that they can't make an argument. But you have to change it, yeah. I don't think you can like, do it the same way.
I'm going to the toilet.